the key is for companies to shift from a reactive compliance posture to a proactive posture. And understanding your risk exposure really starts now. As I said, at its core, it is a data problem. Corporate ownership information is incredibly fragmented. It's spread across hundreds of different government registries around the world. And so it's not something you can just Google. That is the fundamental hurdle, but it is the truth, and companies engaging in global trade should have really robust programs that utilize, you know, the tools of the modern era. So checking entities, checking exporters against a static list is not going to cut it in this ever-changing world.
Welcome to episode 13 of Rittner Reflections, a forum for addressing the dynamic, complex, and essential nature of cross-border trade in our ever-changing world. 2025, I am certain that you need no reminder that we are squarely in the middle of a trade war. Every day and all day, there are news reports of some action, counteraction, or speculation about a pending action that involves global trade. We really have had our attention drawn probably more to tariffs in the past weeks and months than anything else. But there are other actions being taken, other tools, or we could even say weapons that are being used to drive foreign policy and national security agendas, and to implement countermeasures to protect industries and to punish the so-called bad actors. The news on tariffs, interestingly, has been so prevalent that, I mean, I found that when I meet people, I'm at a party, I'm in my running group, I'm on whatever, I meet people and I mention trade, and as soon as I mention the word tariffs, their eyes light up and then, oh, I know exactly what you're talking. I know exactly what you're doing. Everybody, it doesn't matter who you are, is so in tune to the fact that there are all this tariff news going on. But when I talk about some of the other tools, like, for example, the entity list, they have no idea what I'm talking about. So today we are going to talk about some of the other tools that are being utilized around the world. And that is, you know, the use of sanctions or lists that ban certain individuals, entities, countries. In the US, we call this list the entity list. But in China, it is called the unreliable entity list. So we find that every day somewhere around the world, entities, individuals, and even sometimes countries are placed on these lists with regulations that go along with it that prohibit business transactions, even investments, or maybe they require an export license if you do want to, you know, trade. These restrictions we're finding are just becoming more pervasive, more complex, and quite frankly, more just overwhelming. As an example, current example, there's what's called the BIS 50% rule. Now, BIS is the Bureau of Industry and Security. They are the agency under the Department of Commerce that regulates export controls. And this 50% rule is a proposed expansion of U.S. control regulations. And it would apply trade restrictions to any entity that is 50% or more owned by a company that is already listed on this BIS entity list. Or it could be the military end use list, or it could be a designated as a specially designated national, also known as an SDN. It is a proposal, and you know, they may publish it at any moment, or it may never be implemented at this stage, given all of the dynamics, the geopolitical dynamics. But nonetheless, it is creating serious concern among exporters and an industry that is already, as I said, overwhelmed with the ever increasing and complex end user controls. So today I have the wonderful opportunity to discuss these complex and these ever-changing challenges with Melina Villavicencio, who leads the data product function at a company called Sayari. Now, you may never have heard of Sayari. I never heard of Sayari till maybe a year ago. It is a software tool. I know when I worked back at Intel, we engaged with Sayari and began to use some of the aspects of that tool to help us. But where I really got to know Sayari was several months ago, I was invited to their annual conference and back in Washington, D.C. I was allowed to join them for 2 days. And I went to a number of workshops and I had a chance to actually see how the tool works. And I was really amazed just at the capability, at the data and the information that is available to help the industry, help exporters manage this, you know, like I said, ever-increasing challenge around who's the end user, who's actually receiving your product. So I found the tool fascinating, so much so that I wanted to meet with somebody at Sayari for my podcast so that we could dive into this a bit and really understand how exporters could use such a tool to help them navigate just what has become so complex. And so what I learned, just to give you a little background, what I learned about the company, they are on a mission to transform global risk management and corporate transparency by providing this tool that gives instant comprehensive insights into corporate structures and supply chains, and delivers automatic risk intelligence that can be more accurate and reliable than the traditional manual solutions that so many of us have used for years. Essentially, Melina and her team focus on securing access to all of Sayari's data, which is corporate data, trade data, risk, real property, ensuring that the data meets the highest quality standards so it can be trusted, and turning the data into actionable human-grade risk insights that will allow end users to navigate the complexities of this new commercial world with clarity and with confidence. And this includes launching data and features that can help industry and regulators prepare for the policy shifts we're seeing, such as this much anticipated draft BIS 50% rule. Welcome, Melina, to this episode of Written Reflections. I am very excited to have this conversation with you.
Of course, delighted to be here, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I thought just to get your perspective, just if you could talk a bit about the company, you know, from how you experience it, you know, when was it established and why, and when did you join and why?
Yeah, of course. So the company was established over 10 years ago, and today we have multiple products in the market. We have Sayari Graph, we have Sayari Map, we have Sayari Guide, as well as Sayari Signal, right? So I joined the company 4 years ago when we only had one product in the market, and it's evolved significantly since then. But essentially, all of our products are built onto a single core knowledge graph. So that knowledge graph is essentially a map of the global economy. We build that map, that knowledge graph, by connecting billions of disparate public records with, you know, global corporate structures, as well as supply chains. So our data scale is immense. Records on over 500 million companies, all of their kind of affiliated parties, managers, shareholders, beneficial owners. We have bill of lading data in over 60 countries today. And we gather data and harvest data in some high-risk jurisdictions like Russia, China, where we have over 220 million records from companies there alone. And so with kind of this immense and vast network of data, we integrated with global trade data, risk intelligence data, just like the SDN list from OFAC, the entity list that we're going to talk about today, the UFLPA list. And that helps us really enable our clients, right, to see deep into their business networks and uncover non-obvious risks where there may be, for example, sanctions evasion or export controls violations or, you know, for example, forced labor exposure. So through kind of that mission, we support some of the world's most discerning organizations, from major technology companies to, you know, U.S. government. We're really proud to be supporting mission critical needs here.
Wow, that's really impressive. The amount of data that you have gathered and assimilated, that's incredible. So as a company who's trading around the world, what does Sayari offer? What would I gain?
Yeah, so we now have built different products for different use cases. So for example, if you were an AML team in a bank, you could potentially use, Sayari Graph to look at the entities that are applying for or that are wanting to be your customers, right? But we've kind of expanded well beyond that. For example, you can use Sayari Graph also to aid lead generation if you are working on a court case. You can utilize the data in Sayari as court admissible data. And with our newest products, for example, I want to talk a little bit about Sayari Map. You can get visibility into multiple tiers in a specific supply chain through following that specific goods value chain, right? So instead of just looking at, who is doing business with who is sending an export to who, it is really more around, in this specific value chain, this is the specific commodity that is sent and that is an input into making the final good that you are ultimately importing. So you could review actually the full multi-tier supply chain in Sayari Map.
Wow. So one of the things I really appreciated is I was able to attend your latest conference where you demonstrated so many of these features. And I was so impressed with what I saw and the capability that your tool offers. And so I think for those companies that are using your tool, I'm sure they are finding incredible value. And for those that have not explored, it sounds like it would be a great benefit to the work they do. Now, one of the things, Molina, that we're finding in our world today is that who we trade with has become very important. And, trying to understand whether the goods that we trade with are ending up in the right place or the wrong place. And so their government is very concerned about this. So maybe we could just kind of jump into the background on the government for a minute, just to help people understand. So for example, there is this rumored BIS 50% rule. So maybe we could start with who is BIS and what are they trying to accomplish?
Yeah, absolutely. And BIS is, short for the Bureau of Industry and Security. And its role is a balancing act, really, because it's tasked with advancing U.S. national security and foreign policy goals, while at the same time promoting U.S. economic interests and tech leadership in general. So the agency has a long history dating back to the Cold War. It was initially named the BXA, the Bureau of Exports Administration, right? It was created in 87, and it was initially put in place to manage export controls on technology that could be diverted by the Soviet Union. So it was renamed to BIS in 2002, and, really reflecting changes in the world post 9/11, a broader security mission. So its primary function today is to administer the EAR, which I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about today, the Export Administration Regulations, which generally regulate dual use items, right? Commercial goods, software, technology that have legitimate civilian purposes, civilian applications and uses, but can also be used for military or weapons proliferation purposes. And one of the themes that I really wanted to touch on today, when we talk about it in the industry, we tend to talk a lot about like the commodities, right? But the breadth really is more expansive here. They regulate items. And so that's not necessarily just, an export that leaves a port. It is a software, for example, that is provided to an entity that may be regulated by BIS. And so that kind of nuance is really important.
Yes. And so, when I first began to work in this field back in the days of trying to manage Russia, it was a very simple process. I mean, we basically had this idea that you should know your customer. And so there was a small list and you would always check your customer to make sure they weren't on the list. But today, it feels like BIS is more interested not only in who your customer is, but who their customer is and their customer and so on. So explain a little bit more what BIS, again, how does this regulation affect, those of us that are trading?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, the EAR has multiple supplements and multiple ways of BIS enforcement, but What I want to get into a little bit deeper is kind of how the entity list began. And because that really matters to why it's evolving, why it may be evolving, right? So the entity list was first published back in 97, right? 10 years into the existence of the agency. And it had a very narrow mandate, kind of to your point, when back in the day, the purpose of the entity list was specific to weapons of mass destruction. So entities that were initially in there, I believe it was only a few hundred, they were really known to be, really risky in terms of like nuclear proliferation. But the scope has expanded significantly, and especially over the past decade. And so now entities that are added, they're added for a much broader range of applications. So now entities added to this list, they are added either for supporting terrorism or enabling military aggression or even being involved in human rights abuses. So the scope has expanded significantly. And while the list was used sparingly at first, and to your point, exporters only had to check, their direct customer, we have now about over 33, close to 3,400 entities listed today. And while there's a pretty heavy focus on China, China's the top featured country in terms of persons, whether it be companies or individuals. Russia is also highly targeted on the entity list, and we have entities from Pakistan, we have entities from the UAE, we even have entities in the UK and Germany. It's expanded significantly. And now with this proposed rule, or draft rule, it may expand even further. And at that point, if that rule goes into effect, that expansion would go well beyond what's listed. And so that is, the burden on compliance, right? It's going to be more expansive, and there isn't a one size fits all, but happy to talk more about kind of what solutions might be out there.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful, Amalina. I recall when the entity list was first implemented, it was very clear that BIS wanted to get the company's attention and have them come into BIS and explain, why they shouldn't be on the list and why they weren't a risk or what they would need to do to change. And there were some companies that came in, and they actually there's a process to come off the list. But today, with over, what would you say, 3,000 or whatever, I mean, it's almost like this thing has turned into more of a bad guy list as opposed to more of the carrot of, hey, we're concerned, please come in, and so on. So it is interesting to see how this has evolved, and it has made compliance much more difficult and the need for a tool like CRE much more relevant, right? So, one of the things that we always struggled with when I was working in industry is, trying to manage the BIS controls versus the OFAC sanction. Now, OFAC is the Office of Foreign Asset Controls, and they are under Treasury, and they've always implemented sanctions. I mean, that has been their jurisdiction. But now you've got this mingling between the two. So maybe you could help describe, what's the difference and why does that matter?
Yeah, absolutely. And to your earlier point on kind of other things that have made this process even more complex, when there were only a few hundred entities listed, I think what's called, presumption of denial
Yes.
versus, what is the license review policy specifically that applies? It used to be more uniform. Now it really is up to the exporter or the regulated company to check what is the license review policy that may apply to them. But getting into your second question, which is around OFAC. So OFAC enforces, sanctions. They have this SDN list. They have a few other lists, but their main instrument is the Specially Designated Nationals list. And it serves as a tool to change behavior, but it is pretty broad, right? It regulates not only exports like the entity list, but also imports, investments, financial transfers, any type of transaction that may involve entities on the SDN list. Other times it also includes, travel bans, asset freezes, and whatnot. So we can say that the entity list has a more narrow scope in the sense of enforcement, because it applies to export, re-export, or in-country transfer of the items that apply to the entity list. But one of the things that I do want to highlight is the creation of this entity list and the addition of new companies to this entity list, or persons or research centers, it usually requires an interagency consensus, or at least interagency review, right? And that includes not only commerce, it includes also treasury and, you know, energy and state. And so typically, in order for an entity to actually be included into this list, it means there is interagency agreement that there should be, you know, what they call it in the actual enforcement, a red flag, and heightened due diligence into these entities. And, you know, depending on the license policy, a presumption of denial, you know, you may apply, but we're most likely gonna deny that license.
Right. No, that's helpful to understand that nuance. You know, one of the things that I had firsthand experience recently was the U.S. government's concern that U.S. parts were showing up on the battlefield in Ukraine. And I had the wonderful privilege of testifying before Congress on this topic.
It's fascinating.
One of the things that they were very concerned with is that you could sell an item to a party that maybe is not on the entity list, but the item ends up through various means, you know, getting to where it should, we don't want it to go. And so there was a lot of concern. What do we do about that? So you mentioned earlier that the entity list, you know, does include other countries like Russia, like Pakistan. So help us understand, how does BIS expect companies to manage this to ensure those goods don't show up in?
Yeah, that's a great question. And honestly, a point that I really wanted to touch on, this regulation doesn't only matter for U.S. companies, you know, and I think that might be a misconception that, you know, because it's a U.S. agency, and so it would only apply to U.S. exporters, but it really applies to any items in U.S. jurisdiction. And so, for example, if we take one of the highest enforcement actions that the BIS has had was with Seagate, right? That was 2020. The company that was actually, you know, exporting was not a U.S. company. It was the Irish company, right? And I believe that there was a whole web there between Ireland, Singapore, and ultimately Huawei. But at the end of the day, there was U.S. oversight. And more importantly, the goods that were penalized, the reason for the enforcement action was because the goods included substantive U.S. technology. So, you know, and yes, Seagate did have a U.S. presence, and they did have, you know, some U.S. operations. But even if they didn't, honestly, at the end of the day, if there is either sufficient reason for the U.S. to be considered the country of origin of that commodity, or if it's not a commodity, but if it's, you know, an item, a piece of software that has U.S. technology, it's going to be on a case-by-case basis. But it is really important for exporters not to kind of discount that the regulation applies to them only if they're not headquartered in the U.S., right? That's not how that type of enforcement works. And so the other item that comes up a lot, and I'm sure you came across it when you were doing these investigations on Ukraine, the substantial transformation question, right? If there is a component that is of U.S. origin, did it undergo substantial transformation in another jurisdiction before ending up wherever, right? Whether it's in China, whether it's in the Ukraine, Belarus. And it's a burden. It's a burden. The exporters have to be really careful to discover, you know, are they already doing business with an entity in a potential subsidiary, which I'm sure we'll get into as we actually talk about this 50% proposal. But, you know, do they apply for a license? Do they need to start to review the CCL against the specific, you know, potentially HS codes that they're exporting? My answer, you know, would be yes, absolutely. Even if, you know, a tool like Sayari gives you enough visibility into your potential risk, you really have to look into your specific case.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a very difficult problem. I can tell you, because I did have the opportunity to go to Europe and meet at the Ukrainian embassy to look at these parts that were found on the battlefield. And, you know, there was a board like a PCB board, and there were multiple chips that somebody had soldered on there. And so definitely a substantial transformation. But the chips came from all different companies, and some of them were old, some of them were newer, and so on. And so this is a really difficult problem to attack. And I think BIS is under a lot of pressure to provide companies with, you know, better or ask companies to do more diligence to gain more information to ensure that this doesn't happen. And so we've all heard over the last, I'd say, month or so that there is this rumored BIS 50% rule that they're looking to implement. And I'd like to kind of dive into that a bit, because I think this is really where I think your company and your tool can really help traders who are trying to manage this very complex situations. Let's start with some basics just for our listeners here. What is the 50% rule, and what's kind of the rationale for kind of implementing it now?
Yeah. So the first time we heard about from an actual, you know, government official about the potential rule was around April in the confirmation hearing of Landon Heed. And he kind of had framed it as a relatively straightforward tweak that would have the potential of having great benefits in terms of enforcement, because it would be closing a subsidiary loophole. And the rationale there is, you know, entities may be setting up subsidiaries in order to do business with, you know, U.S. companies. So closing that subsidiary loophole, let's say, you know, let's take that example of Seagate as well. You know, Huawei could have a subsidiary in a different country outside of China, and, you know, how the entity list tends to list different addresses, like in a completely different address, but still be connected through an ownership, direct ownership chain to that parent company. The goal here would be to close that loophole by kind of recreating a similar logic from what OFAC already enforces. OFAC has been enforcing the 50% rule since, I think, their interim guidance was in 2008. And then their aggregate revision and newest policy came out in 2014. So it's been a while that OFAC has been enforcing it. So taking some of that, you know, the same enforcement logic that is used for OFAC, which is, you know, OFAC doesn't tell you who are the subsidiaries. That is, you know, the industry to figure out and to actually conduct that due diligence. And so it would be a similar implementation here, where should this rule go into effect, I'm going to presume, you know, Commerce is not going to give us a list of the subsidiaries to screen against. That burden would fall on the actual exporter. And so we heard this in April, but then in June, mid-June, we also heard from Tim Mooney that indeed the proposed rule is in the works. It is in draft format. Now, we have not seen it in the Federal Register yet, which suggests either, you know, it would potentially go into effect as a IFR rather than a full, you know, public comment period for 60 days, we really don't know. I don't want to speculate too much here, but we have heard confirmation that there is a draft rule, that it is in the works. And so I think it is the right time to start preparing your compliance teams. We shouldn't really wait until the rule goes into effect. You know, depending on the industry, the business, ultimately this could be a rule that impacts your bottom line, though, because penalties are pretty high. You know, Seagate got fined $300 million. And so the time to prepare is now. Of course, we should expect BIS to give some, you know, grace period for compliance programs to adjust. But we heard confirmation that in June that this is in the works. And so I think I would classify it as a little bit more confirmed than a rumor, just because we got that confirmation now that it's likely to go into effect.
Right. No, I can, thanks for that, Melina. I can verify or validate your point, because I was in the RAPTAC, Regulation Procedures and Technical Advisory Committee, which I serve on, and I sat one person away from Tim Mooney, and Tim Mooney told us that they're working on a rule. Yep. So you're absolutely correct. There is a draft rule that is being worked on. And I'm not sure, I don't know whether we will have an opportunity at RAPTEC to see it before it's published or not, but I do think your point of being prepared is valid and appropriate for those that do trade globally. Let me just jump back, because you talked a bit about OFAC has been doing this all along. And so what's the difference? I mean, why is OFAC have a 50% and BIS doesn't? And what is it going to make everything the same? Or what's the difference? What's really going on here with this?
So it's a lot of nuance here, because I don't wanna not talk about the fact that many entities on the entity list are also on the SDN list. So if that entity is already on the SDN list, you know, your trade compliance team already had to have been performing that 50% analysis. Now, not all entities on the SDN list are, you know, there's no one-to-one overlap here. And so, you know, there are multiple lists that are potentially overlapping. For example, the Department of Defense has its own 1260H list. Many entities on this 1260H list, which, you know, has the goal of the policy goal of targeting military civil fusion in China. Some entities in the 1260H list are also in the entity list. Some entities are in the entity list and also in the SDN list. That's why we have a consolidated screening list, right? But to your point, there are many, many potential subsidiaries that would not have been caught only by the OFAC 50 screening process. And so what we've done at Sayari, as soon as we heard, you know, hey, there is a draft rule, even before, you know, it went up in the Federal Register, because it hasn't. As soon as we heard, you know, there's a draft rule in the works, we started harvesting all of that seed data, basically the data that seed risk data is actually the entity list, but also the corporate registry filings from China, from Russia, from Pakistan, from Germany, the UK, the UAE, etc. And then calculating multi-hop ownership through, I believe at this point, it's up to 6 hops of ownership. So 6 levels of potential subsidiaries using that 50% OFAC logic. Now, BIS has not, because this has not been published, we do not have official confirmation that it would be the exact same logic that OFAC uses. I think we can assume it will be. But you know, the OFAC algorithm has some nuances, right? They account for direct and indirect ownership. They also account for aggregate ownership, meaning if there are 2 separate SDNs that own a third non-SDN company, that third would be considered sanctioned by extension. And so we don't know if that exact same nuance will apply, if, you know, they will take the aggregate logic as well, if they will, you know, also consider indirect ownership. I think we can assume they might take, it would be the logical step to take the same OFAC guidance, but there hasn't been actual confirmation of what exactly the 50% application is going to be like. And 50% applications, you know, it's difficult. The US has its own application. The UK has a slightly different application. The EU has a slightly different application. So we can only hope that the BIS actually follows the same US application than OFAC.
Right. So help me understand this. If the goal is to expand the net wider to capture more of the so-called bad actors, right, by getting a hold of their subsidiaries, I mean, what's to prevent a company to change all of its legal entity structures to be 49% as opposed to 50%?
I mean, that's always the catch, right? The assumption here that OFAC has been guided by is over 50% ownership indicates direct control, right? Direct control, whether that's through like voting stake or direct actual shareholder, and that decision making can be made by that 50%. Now, Of course, the risk remains. The risk remains. Bad actors evolve quickly. They're very adaptable. I mean, I was doing some research about how quickly, you know, for example, Mexican cartels operate, which is a completely different typology we're talking about here. But at the end of the day, you know, these actors utilize the same ports. These actors utilize the same global economic system, the same banks a lot of times. And so we should expect them to evolve. And I would say, is there something preventing them from, you know, tweaking their ownership structure, creating a few shell companies here and there, and having that threshold be lower? They can. And that is where it is really imperative that the guidance is clear, because, you know, for OFAC, ownership is sanctioned by extension, but control is more nuanced. Control is more nuanced, and it's not directly sanctioned. And so if it's control without ownership, OFAC has guidance, and, you know, ultimately there are plenty of law firms, and I'm sure, you know, most companies have general counsel that would be able to advise on those specific nuances and give, you know, a go or no go. But it's really important that the guidance is clear. What happens? Is it, you know, 50% only? Is it 50% aggregate? I really hope that guidance is there for industry, and honestly, for technology companies like us also to actually provide the solution that mirrors the regulation exactly as it is written.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's obvious that there is a challenge if you're BIS to really try to address this. But as a company who's trying to, you know, transact business globally, it's really difficult. And so it's wonderful that we have tools and systems like Sayari's solution. And so let's just shift over to your tool and let's talk about that. So how can a company prepare for this sort of complex rule that's coming?
Yeah, absolutely. And that gets at the heart of the issue, really. I think an anecdote here. So I was at a conference last week. The chatter around this, there was a lot of it. And the head of trade compliance at a conglomerate company, you know, came to me and she said, we don't even know where to begin because our OFAC, you know, our OFAC or our sanctions screening department is already really robust, and we've had a lot of time to adapt, and we have the SME in-house, but we really don't even know where to start with this potential BIS ruling. It is difficult. It might be insurmountable. We're not resourced. We're probably not going to get further resourcing. And, you know, in her organization, it seemed like, you know, the sanction screening had a bit of a different mandate and was in a bit of a separate budget, you know, let's say line from, you know, actual exports compliance. And I want to challenge that it would be insurmountable or like really difficult to just get started. And that's where tools like Sayari can come into place. I don't think exporters have to start from scratch. Honestly, expecting exporters to map every single subsidiary across, you know, in corporate records that are in disparate languages, disparate structures and formats. Some of them are even inaccessible by design, right? Where do they even get started? You know, my answer there is solutions like Sayari are the right starting point because, you know, we built already this huge network of corporate relationships, of trade relationships. And what the Sayari screening solution at this time gives you is a list of a few thousand entities that we have validated through our algorithm are potential subsidiaries from the list. And so Sayari is not going to give you legal advice, say do business, don't do business, apply for a license, don't apply for a license. I'm not here to do that. And our product certainly won't try to do that. But, you know, technology does not take away the need for human judgment. And what we are trying to do and looking to do is give trade compliance teams the right starting point. So then they can decide, hey, you know, all of the information that I had from Sayari is up to date, and I can download all of the records, and then I can go ahead and escalate this right away to, you know, management. Or, hey, look, here, I'm seeing a different address from the list, and this is very common, right? entities that use different addresses in their filings. Maybe I want to take a second look here. I want to ensure that these are the actually true positive companies that I'm getting a hit on, and I want to make that judgment call. So what we are trying to do here is by no means eliminate the element of human judgment, but actually give teams the power to make decisions faster. And so that is the way that we are trying to transform a really time-consuming process into a more streamlined process. You know, let's take this example of this trade compliance leader that I was talking to. If they are, for example, shipping hundreds of thousands of commodities or actual shipments from a few hundred commodities, it would be an impossible feat for them to really go ahead and build all of that manually. And so the flag that you would get with Sayari is not the end of the process, but it is the beginning of that high value human work. I would say, you know, that's how our solution can really help.
So if I understand, if I just kind of what you've described as an exporter, let's say, or a trader, you know, I'm facing this, you know, daunting task of trying to understand who I'm actually dealing with. So what your tool will give me is it gives me a data relationships of companies and entities in countries, and allows me then to gather that data and then use my own judgment based on my risk tolerance to try to determine whether I should proceed or I shouldn't proceed. Is that a fair way of describing?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we're talking about the entity list right now. So yes, we have developed this for the entity list. We developed it in record time, but our tool can do that for a multitude of regulations, right? Our tool can do that for the UFLPA list. Our tool can do that for the good old SDN list. And so
yes.
For UFLPA, we have a few, you know, additional methodologies, like looking at the actual, unified Chinese social credit codes to see where a company was actually registered, looking at the business purpose, extracting keywords to see, hey, might there be a forced re-education is how they frame it, right, in this company. And we packaged that into what we call our risk factors, right? For the entity list, we have a specific set of risk factors. They are the I believe BIS 50 is what we're referencing those risk factors as. We have those risk factors available in our software tools, so in Sayari Graph, in Sayari Map, and then we also are offering a specific data file that only includes the names of the actual potential subsidiaries.
Well, before we kind of wrap up, Melina, can you kind of maybe just walk through a hypothetical case. So let's say I'm a trader and I've got a customer that I want to sell my product to who's in, let's say in China.
Yeah.
What would I do with your tool? How walk me through a kind of a case, how this works.
Look, I mean, if you have a customer in China, I would say the process is may be a bit more straightforward, but let's say your customer is in Malaysia or in Thailand, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know who is their buyer, right? That is something that Sayari can help with. So for instance, if we look at the entity list, let's say, you know, you are looking to ship either, you know, semiconductors or a harmless consumer good. That difference is what Sayari can help you map. But, you know, at the end of the day, having the data from those over 60 countries and having that specific bill of lading data, having that corporate data, what it helps you is, you know, to actually make a judgment call. Is my customer supplying the same good that I am sending, or a transformed good with the same input to that Chinese company? Or is this Chinese company their customer, but on a completely different value chain that has nothing to do with me, right? That is what you can tell through Sayari. Instead of, you know, going and asking your customer, are you using this, what I'm shipping to you in order to ship it to China, you can tell. And then, you know, you can also validate that your supply chain is clean, that you can have that peace of mind by validating through the data that we have that there's nothing to worry about. And that's also a lot of value, not just identifying where there's risk, but the absence of risk is just equally important. So that's how our solutions can continue to help.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Thank you for kind of going through that. This is an audio podcast, so we can't do visuals, but I have seen the visuals. I sat in the conferences and I saw your tool in action, and I saw the way you map and how you can figure out the connections of different entities to one another, and how that, like you said, either emphasizes or identifies a risk or not, and allows you to then proceed forward with a sense of security.
Yeah, ease and confidence. That's the goal.
Yeah, ease and confidence. Absolutely. Well, I want to, as we close, Melina, just mention that, Ciari, from what I've seen, just looked like an amazing tool to help. How does one engage?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have on our website. Well, the first thing that I'm going to say is I'm going to recommend folks to actually go ahead and register for our webinar that happened a few days ago. I believe you can still get a copy of the recording because it was on this very same topic and we had a fantastic lineup of speakers. But yes, we have a website. We have a contact form. You can receive a demo if you fill out that contact form within a matter of less than a week. And go from there. We are a multi-product company now, so you can absolutely explore what might be the solution that best fits your needs.
Yeah, I saw. I participated in a series where you're looking at managing tariff risk.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that. I know there's AI work going, so it's very exciting to see all the things that you guys are developing. And I would highly recommend our listeners, if this has piqued your interest, if this is an area that you are concerned about, I would highly recommend, taking a look at the webinar and probably your website and to explore this further. As we finish, Melina, just anything else that you wanted to communicate before we stop?
Another point that I wanted to touch on, the key is for companies to shift from a reactive compliance posture to a proactive posture. And understanding your risk exposure really starts now. As I said, at its core, it is a data problem. Corporate ownership information is incredibly fragmented. It's spread across hundreds of different government registries around the world. And so it's not something you can just Google. That is the fundamental hurdle, but it is the truth. And companies engaging in global trade should have really robust programs that utilize, the tools of the modern era. So checking entities, checking exporters against a static list is not going to cut it in this ever-changing world. We have new regulations coming out all the time. And so how our tools can help is helping you become that proactive compliance team that is tracking when a regulation may come up, when it may be published, and you've already done the work of checking that your specific supply chain, who your customers are, who your buyers are in compliance with all of the rules. As a closing remark, I would just say, we talked in depth about the specific regulation, and this is part of a much broader toolkit of regulations in a much broader geopolitical scenario with everything that's going on between the U.S. and China, from, the removal of the de minimis exception that they had to the entirety of what's been the past few months with tariffs. And so, these are the regulations that Ciari in general can help with, but just kind of closing and emphasizing that we are here to empower the analyst, to empower the trade compliance professional to do their jobs faster. And so really glad to be here, Jeff. It was a pleasure talking to you. And I can tell you have so much industry knowledge on these very same topics. So yeah, thank you very much for having me.
It's been wonderful to have this conversation, and I wish you all the best as you go forward. It is a very interesting time that we live in, for sure.
Yeah, yes.
So thanks again. Thanks again, Melina. Take care.
Thank you, Jeff.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye. You have been listening to episode 13 of Written Reflections, a forum for addressing the dynamic, complex, and essential nature of cross-border trade in our ever-changing world. Thank you for joining me today.